People turn their backs on you when you label something. Officers turn their back on you when you label something.
I was stripped of everything, of all my clothes. After that, I was allowed to put certain parts of my clothes back on. Then I was handcuffed to a metal rod, which was to the wall, until these people came and got me.
Well, historically, there have been not particularly good practices by police in the whole managing of eyewitness identifications.
I think that what happened is that they were trying very hard to solve a series of rapes that had happened in the Bronx.
There is a financial consequence which can provide a motivation for fighting to preserve convictions. A composite drawing was made. Those are notoriously lame.
Someone calls up and doesn't say that they know Tyrone had anything to do with this incident. They had no specific information about the incident, but they're like, oh, he looks like that sketch.
This is Scott Reeder, founder of Suspect Convictions. There is no greater violation than being sexually assaulted. I know this because when I was 12 years old, a man attacked me. It has left scars on my sense of self that I am still dealing with. In fact, it has taken me 40 years to speak publicly about what happened. That's why I hurt for a woman who was attacked, February 23rd, 1998.
The then 27-year-old woman was assaulted in a phone booth in the Bronx, New York. She was dragged out of the booth into an alley. The man then attempted to rape her, ripping off her clothes and pushing himself first against her vagina and then her face. The attacker squeezed the victim's neck and told her he was going to have to put her to sleep. The woman escaped when a neighbor in a nearby apartment heard yelling and shouted at the attacker, prompting him to flee. Newspaper headlines dubbed the assailant the Bronx Rapist. There had been numerous attacks against women in the Bronx, and people believed one man was responsible. The woman who was attacked in this case was taken to a hospital where sexual assault evidence was collected, including scrapings from under her fingernails. The victim helped police create a composite sketch of her attacker, and after it was published in the media, a tipster called the police and said the sketch resembled 41-year-old Tyrone Hicks.
Well, what happened is that I didn't know really what was going on. I was on parole for a case that I had. I came home, and it was like 2 months right after I came home that this incident that occurred on February 23rd in 1998 came about. And I was accused of two charges, and I didn't understand why they happened in the first place, but I was arrested because of it. And I was in Montrose, New York at the time, where I was being evaluated to go into their hospital. It's VA in Montrose, New York. State troopers had asked me about my name and stuff, and I gave it to them, and they asked what I come with them. So they just told me somebody wanted to speak to me, but I really didn't know what was going on by them telling me all this in the first place, but I kind of was getting ready to go with them. But it seems like, you know, by me volunteering myself to go with these state troopers, because I was on a government facility, in order for you to be taken off a government facility, you have to be asked and escorted off. And that's what happened. I was in handcuffs. Didn't know why I was in handcuffs. If you ask me where I go with you, I did a voluntary. So why did you put cuffs on me without telling me I was under arrest or whatever? Seeing like when I got to the troopers' barracks, things started happening that I didn't feel comfortable with. And I did ask for permission to call my parent to let her know what was going on, which was my mother. I was refused to make any phone calls. They told me I had to wait until whoever was coming to get me. And that's what I did, from almost 9 o'clock in the morning to almost 6 o'clock in the afternoon. I was refused to go to the bathroom. I was refused a lot of things, which I didn't understand why I was being refused. If you asked me to go somewhere, and I kind of obliged by just going with you, and I didn't understand. I was stripped of everything, of all my clothes. After that, I was allowed to put certain parts of my clothes back on. Then I was handcuffed to a metal rod, which was to the wall, and so these people came and got me.
The only evidence against him was the victim's identification. No physical or forensic evidence connected him to the crime. The defense pointed out that the victim had given inconsistent descriptions of her attacker at various times. Two alibi witnesses, including Hicks' son-in-law, testified that Hicks was at home at the time of the crime. Faulty witness identification is the number one reason for wrongful convictions in the United States, says Maurice Possley, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has focused much of his career on issues involving wrongful convictions.
Well, historically, there have been not particularly good practices by police in the whole managing of eyewitness identifications. First of all, there's been an incredible amount of research that shows that we are not like video cameras, that we can play back what we saw with any kind, with the same kind of accuracy that you can play back a videotape. Study after study after study has shown how people make mistakes, and particularly when people are under stress, such as the stress of when a gun is being either pointed at you or actually fired at you, or a weapon, or you're under some sort of duress, you're being assaulted, sexually assaulted. That's why the Innocence Project, which only does DNA cases, has such a high percentage, because DNA cases are predominantly sexual assault cases, and those are cases where the witness is the victim, and particularly in cross-racial situations. There's been a ton of research that shows that people have difficulty identifying people of different races. But the whole practice of how witness identifications are come about, there's a whole lot of bad stuff that can go on. In the Hicks case, you have a composite drawing was made. Those are notoriously lame, which is probably an understatement by a lot. They're just notoriously bad because they're basically a person is trying within a day or so is now trying to recreate with someone else's hand drawing the picture, or whether they can do this now mechanically, but those just are notoriously bad. And you see, you know, in his case, it was published, and then someone thinks that, yeah, it looks like him. Then they bring them in, and it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now you've got someone that looks like the composite that's put into either a photographic lineup or a live lineup, and there are all sorts of things that we now know can be done to manipulate people into the wrong identifications, identifying the person that the police want them to identify. And a lot of best practices have been enacted by some places, have been shown to reduce the number of false identifications. And it's one of those practices that, the same way with recording interrogations, that some police are reluctant to put in place, because they feel like they won't be able to make their cases, or that the guilty will go free. And that's the view from one end of the telescope, you might say, as opposed to sending the innocent to prison.
The case had been dubbed the Bronx Rapist by New York tabloids, and Tyrone Hicks's lawyer, Adele Bernhardt, said that the detectives working the case were under enormous pressure to make the arrest.
Now, there was press about it, so I am sure that they felt pressure to solve the crime. I think what happened, you see, is that they talked to the complainant. They got a description. She was extremely clear that the person who assaulted her was bald. She was clear on his age. He was close to her age. So those were two distinguishing characteristics. And then sort of over time, this bald thing somehow disappears because Tyrone isn't bald and he wasn't close to her age. He was 40 years old. So, you know, it clearly something happened to change her memory. She was somehow influenced through the process. And what had happened is that she had worked with a sketch artist to create a sketch. And this is a pretty standard investigatory procedure that the police use, but unfortunately, it can really distort memory. And it opens up a greater number of people who could be identified as the perpetrator because these sketches tend to be very generic and look like any number of different people. So they created this sketch, and then they made a poster from the sketch. And then someone calls up, and we have no idea who it is. Someone calls up and doesn't say that they know Tyrone had anything to do with this incident. They had no specific information about the incident, but they're like, oh, he looks like that sketch. So then the police focused on Tyrone and decided, really, that he was the perpetrator. And then they told, I believe, they told the victim that they had information leading to him. Of course, they didn't, but that was how they presented it to her. And so when she saw his photograph, she didn't just see it unencumbered with their opinion. She saw it with their opinion, and at that point, you know, she sort of went along with what they were suggesting, which is this is the guy.
So do you think the detectives are deliberately trying to do this?
I think that what happened is that they were trying very hard to solve a series of rapes that had happened in the Bronx. And they were very excited when they got this tip, and they thought that they were going to solve a whole bunch of crime. And I think it's just really, it's not intentional. It's, you know, I think it's sloppy. And they put him in three, they had three different people view the lineup. And the other people were assaulted by somebody, and they thought it was the same person that had assaulted everybody. And the other two gals said, oh, no, he's not the one. So they should have understood at that point that he hadn't assaulted this victim either, and it probably was the same person who had assaulted everybody. But instead of saying to themselves, gee, two people say it's not him, I guess we've got the wrong guy, they said, well, okay, so he didn't do those two, but he did this one. Even though they had thought that they were looking for one person that had a similar MO who had committed all three of the crimes. You know, clearly you could have interpreted this evidence in a different way than they interpreted it.
On June 15, 2000, Hicks was convicted of first-degree attempted rape and first-degree attempted sodomy. He was sentenced to 8 years in prison.
Tyrone, you had a pretty rough time of it in prison, didn't you?
Well, fighting on a tyrant child to survive is not easy. I was supposed to be in protected custody. I went to the library. At that time, I had an afro. One of the guys put my hair on fire. I called my lawyer, told him about that. He asked me, do I want to move? But anywhere I go, it's not going to do me no good because I'm always going to be having problems. Then I had a fight with another guy in the day room. He took two chairs. We had gotten into a fight for no reason. Just came up to me and just took the chairs and just went at me. And I got into a fight with him. Then I had to get removed. Then I was sent to Clinton, to Danny Moore. And I had to stay there until I brought back down. I had another fight when I got back into Mid-State. There's places that, you know, I had to fight for, try to maintain myself. And I was being there quite a few times, but the bottom line is, what you going to do? People turn their backs on you when you label something. Officers turn your back on you when you label something. You know, this is how it was. You know, it's rough when you get to a jail the first day and then you wake up early in the morning and you got the guy that's under you and hung himself. Then you turn around the next day, there was a guy next door to me on the other side of the cell, and he hanged his son. So, yes, I did want to try to commit suicide my own self because of what was going on. I couldn't take it. Yes, I was stressed out. I was always stressing out. You know, it's not fun to be somewhere where you don't need to be. You know, it's not. You try to make phone calls. You got to go outside to use the phone in Clinton, and you got to be on a lift to go outside to use the phone. And then when you got it down 25 below zero and you got icicles on your face from trying to use the phone when it's cold out there and it's raining, to call home just to see what's going on, and you only got a certain amount of time to use the phone anyway, it's not good. Yes, it's not good when you got to lay down on the ground, when you got people fighting, and then you got to lay on the ground in Clinton where they got the guns coming out to shoot. So you can lay down on the ground to whatever's happening out there in the yard for the people to be escorted. So basically, you know, it's not good. I lost a lot of stuff. Stuff got stolen in the process. Every time I turned around, I was getting my cell tossed for no reason. I'm losing things, broken things, which I didn't understand that either. From jail to jail, you're riding around from 3 o'clock in the morning to at least 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, back and forth on a bus, just to go from one jail to another, which is crazy. You know, just to have the rings around your legs and around your arms after you've been transported for so long, and just waiting for them, just your wrists and your feet, for the rings to disappear after 3 or 4 days, just for one day, for riding around, is crazy. So basically, I don't wish this on nobody, and I wish it never happened. But like I said before, even when I made my statement, when I was released, I'm sorry for the young lady that it happened to.
There are two compounding tragedies of this crime. One is that Tyrone Hicks was wrongly convicted of a crime he did not commit, and the other is that the man who did commit this crime was never punished.
You know something, and it's sad to say that, you know, when I used to watch the shows that Barry Sheck used to have on the TV about innocent people going to jail and coming home, and I was always watching this picture that he always put on, and it caught my eye to watch it every time it came on. Well, Chestnut was the one that was the person to talk about these things that was going on every episode. And then to find out, I'm one of them same people that got caught up in something that I've been watching all this time. Because sometimes when you look at that thing, you never think it happened to you until it happened to you. And I'm dumbfounded that, you know, that this happened. And I don't wish this on nobody. I just met a lot of people in the conference where I went here in Memphis, Tennessee, up here last month, of people being innocent and try to prove it. It's very hard. I have a man right now that was talking to a lawyer that he's innocent, but don't know how to get help. So what do we do?
While Hicks was in prison, he wrote to the Post-Conviction Project at Pace Law School. After his release in 2007, Pace Post-Convicted Project students discovered the fingernail scrapings, which had never been tested. In 2009, the New York Office of the Medical Examiner, with the consent of the Bronx District Attorney, conducted DNA tests on a wooden dowel that was used to scrape the victim's fingernails. The tests revealed a partial DNA profile. In 2010, the medical examiner issued a report that the male DNA profile did not match Hicks. The DNA profile was only a partial profile that was sufficient to exclude Hicks, but was not sufficient to send to the FBI's DNA dataset to determine if it was matched to a convicted felon. But Tyrone Hicks' attorney, Adele Bernhardt, said the Bronx District Attorney did not embrace the new evidence.
All I know is that they said, well, we're not convinced. We're not convinced that that's the rapist's DNA underneath the fingernails. Well, what's the point of scraping fingernails if you're not going to use the information for any purpose? You use it to convict people every day. They've convicted tons of people in New York with no more evidence than DNA under the victim's fingernails. They're solving crimes every day of the week with fingernails. So you're really telling me that you convict somebody on this evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, and you don't think it is a reasonable doubt when I'm making a motion to vacate this fellow's conviction when you have no other evidence connecting him to the crime except this gal's memory, which was not particularly reliable?
It is not surprising that the Bronx District Attorney continued to fight for Tyrone Hicks to remain incarcerated, said journalist Maurice Possley.
And these are people who, in the face of compelling evidence, even DNA evidence, refuse to admit that a mistake was made. And I think part of that is there's a lot of hubris that's involved. I think part of it is to be involved in a case where the wrong person was convicted is bad enough. It's compounded if there is a real criminal out there that goes on to commit other crimes, and we know that's happened, and horrible crimes, murders, rapes. That's tough to live with. There are people who did things improperly because they believed that the person was guilty. And so they cut corners, they cheated, they withheld evidence, and they don't want to admit that they did that. So I think there's a variety of factors.
Well, you know, the prosecutor who originally prosecuted the case may be long gone, but yet you have his successors still defending his work. Why do you think that is? You think it's just a product of the office?
Well, I think that there's certainly a loyalty that transcends administrations to the office, per se. I also think that there are other things at stake here, and one of them is financial compensation and damages, particularly in cities like, say, Chicago, which are self-insured, and so every penny that's paid out comes out of the taxpayer's pocket. And so you have the county, which is the prosecutor, basically defending cases that are made by Chicago police officers. And if you look at the amounts of money that have been paid out over the last couple of decades in Chicago, I think in the John Burge torture cases, it's well over $100 million. You have some of the individual cases. You know, the Ford Heights 4 case was $36 million. There have been some individual cases in the tens and $20 million. So there is a financial consequence which can provide a motivation for fighting to preserve convictions.
Hicks subsequently filed a claim for compensation with the New York Court of Claims that was settled for $1.5 million. He also filed a federal civil rights lawsuit that was dismissed, but in January 2018 was reinstated by the Second Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals.
Today, I'm joined by Michelle Ben Simon, who's our narrator, and also a true crime fan who lives in Montreal. Welcome, Michelle.
So, what was your reaction to the case? I mean, when you read up on it.
I mean, yeah, it is extremely tragic for both parties because I think, as always, the most tragic thing is that the person who did it wasn't caught, and I think that, you know, like in most of these cases, just having someone go through the experience of being in prison and, you know, as a sex offender, I think there's a entirely different way that you're treated in prison as to, you know, someone who's in there for theft or for something different. And once you're on that sex offender list, your life is completely over. There's no real turning back from that. I don't, and it's so tragic to me.
Well, one of the things that Tyrone was telling me is that trick-or-treaters weren't allowed to come to his home on Halloween because he was a registered sex offender. He wasn't allowed to go to family parties if there was going to be any children present. There was a whole list of things that he couldn't do. And the sad thing is he didn't commit the crime. But I mean, even after he got out of prison, he really couldn't walk away from what was haunting him, this false allegation that was made. I mean, I don't know how somebody copes in a situation like that. Even moving away from several states away from where it happened, you really couldn't escape it. I mean, it's just a really sad thing. You know, I interviewed Tyrone's mother, and I chatted with her, and she's still very angry about the whole thing. And she's not only angry at the state of New York for prosecuting her son, but she's angry at the young woman. And I can't help but think maybe that's misplaced anger. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I really do feel for the woman as well. I mean, she was attacked, and it seems like she couldn't, you know, properly identify. And I think in those situations, you're just looking for somewhere to put the blame, to put the answer, to feel like that book is closed. Because I can imagine not wanting to ever believe that that person is still out there and that that danger still lives. So being able to put somebody away and feeling in the moment, I mean, I can imagine that there's just so much trauma and so many things going through her mind that it would be probably hard to completely identify somebody.
You know, as I said earlier in this episode, one of the things that, you know, I was assaulted when I was 12, and just a horrible, horrible situation. And there's still things that haunt me about that 40 years later. I mean, sex offenses are such a heinous and horrible thing. I mean, I don't think people always understand just how deep the violation is when something like that happens.
Yeah, I can't imagine truly like what that would feel like for women or men. It doesn't matter. It's all the same.
And the unfortunate part too is in our society, we cast such a stigma on the victims of these type of crimes, and which I've never been quite able to understand. We tend to like, oh my goodness, you know, this person's now tainted or something like that. And it was like, it took me a long, long time to get to the point where I could feel, I could speak about it publicly. And earlier this year, I wrote a newspaper column about the experience, and that was a very cathartic experience. But I mean, you know, I don't know how it would be for somebody who is assaulted, goes to the police, and gets presented with all of these different photographs and picks the wrong person. Just, you know, an honest mistake, but picks the wrong person. Wouldn't you feel an overwhelming sense of guilt or something? Gosh, I not only had to go through this horrible experience myself, but then I picked the wrong person who did this, and then he ended up going to prison on based solely on my testimony.
Yeah, that seems like, but I also do understand feeling like so overwhelmed by everything being thrown at you and by, you know, the police and by all these people who are trying to maybe even push you in the direction of identifying someone and you not being ready, but feeling like you have to.
Yeah. And you can't help but wonder. I mean, one of the things that is such a problem with these type of photo lineups is they aren't always done in the most careful, systematic way. I mean, when they present the photos, if you have the person there that's presenting the photos may have his own suspect. And sometimes we can send subtle clues, even inadvertent clues, to somebody who you think it is. You know, like, are you sure it was not this guy? Are you positive? You know, and it's something that compounds on itself. It's very hard to do those in a very objective manner that's not going to influence the victim.
Upon being released from prison, he still wasn't really a free man until a judge fully exonerated him. One of the most trying experiences was being on the sex offender registry in a small town. His attorney, Adele Bernhardt, said he was shunned.
it's more than a stigma. I mean, it's humiliating. He moved to South Carolina about 2 weeks after he was released. And in South Carolina, they require you to re-register quarterly as a sex offender. And then they print your picture in the newspaper so that everybody sees all the sex offenders. So 4 times a year, his photograph was in the local newspaper. And this is not like being in New York where probably nobody looks at these newspapers. This is a local small town where everybody looks at the newspapers. So everyone sees him as this horrible sex offender. And when you read that someone's a sex offender, you don't know what that means. That means that he was like torturing children. I mean, it was horrible. And he wasn't allowed to go to any parties where children were present. Even his own nieces and nephews and grandnieces and nephews and grandchildren. So it was very restrictive. But most of all, I think it was extremely humiliating. So for somebody who suffers from a sense of inadequacy, which he does, this really exacerbated his feelings of incompetence, inadequacy, not being a full human being and a member of society.
Tyrone Hicks is striving to improve not only his own life, but that of others around him. But he remains haunted by those years in prison.
Well, I am currently trying to maintain myself. I'm into Narcotics Anonymous. I've been in that. Been in that since 2009. My chair meetings, I go to rehabs, I go into centers where I speak at. My chairperson for doing those things.
Tyrone, how long have you been sober?
9 years, it'll be 9 years, 2 months, and I mean, how many days?